Welcome to the Resilience Rising podcast with me, your host, Jen Scottney. With the help of my guests, we will be getting curious about what resilience is, how we develop it, and the times we've used it. This podcast is here to explore all things resilience. Today, I get to chat to Jo Mosley. Jo is a best-selling author, podcaster, and award-winning short filmmaker. In 2019, after coming through a divorce, the bereavement of her mum, and her sons growing up, Jo became the first woman to stand up paddleboard 162 miles, coast to coast, from Liverpool to Goole. She was also picking up litter and fundraising as she went. There's a film about her adventure called Brave Enough, A Journey Home to Joy, by award-winning filmmaker Frit Tam, which was selected for prestigious film festivals such as Kendall Mountain Film Festival and Shoe Extreme, plus sellout online screenings. The lessons learned from the challenge and a podcast, The Joy of Sup, the Paddleboarding Sunshine podcast, gave Jo the confidence to pitch her first book in 2020 during lockdown. In 2022, that became her first best-selling book, and Stand Up Paddleboarding in Great Britain was published by award-winning Vertebrate Publishing. It is the first and currently only Great Britain-wide travel guide dedicated to paddleboarding. Her second book, Stand Up Paddleboarding in the Lake District, will be published in May 2024. Jo loves sharing the joy of fresh air, hiking, dipping in the sea and lakes, as well as beach cleaning. She has a headstand a day until I'm 60 practice and is also learning to skateboard. So lovely to chat to you, Jo.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such an honour to be on your podcast.
Honour to have you. The honour is all mine. Shall we pretend that you're doing a headstand while we're recording?
Yes. I'll only be up for about a minute or two, though. But yeah.
How did the headstand start? I love seeing those on your Instagram.
So I had COVID in March last year, and also I'd injured my ribs. So like, I just injured my ribs. I was just getting better, then I got COVID, and it wasn't like it was. I felt really poorly with COVID, but it came and it went. I was lucky, very fortunate in that respect, and I just felt grim. I just felt grim. And so I thought, I want to do something that is joyful each day, that reminds me that I can do something different, different perspectives, something joyful, just something that would take 2 minutes a day just to say, stop, breathe, turn yourself upside down. and I could do it as my ribs were healing. I just started doing it, and then I thought, I'll put it on my Instagram stories and every so often on my grid, and I've got it on my highlights, and it just literally, and I try and do it mainly outside, and I try and do it in like beautiful places if I'm, researching a book or going somewhere. Or like last week I was in London and I thought, I'm not going to do it outside. It's just not going to happen here. But I did it in a very quiet little, square in Clapham on a couple of days. And then the other day I did it in the South Bank Centre. I found this little corridor and I just went and did it. And then I took a picture of the Thames and the view from the South Bank. It's just this tiny, tiny little thing that brings me joy.
Oh, it brings everybody else joy as well. Have you got an army of people joining you? I'm afraid I haven't done a headstand yet, but I can do. And how long are you going to be doing it for, if you're going to be doing it until you're 60?
So I hopefully, all being well, turn 60 at the end of this year. And so I put until I'm 60 and hopefully beyond. So I think I'll just keep trying and doing it. I'll just keep doing it until I can't do it.
You're like the Forrest Gump of headstands.
Sorry?
You're the Forrest Gump of headstands.
Yes, exactly. I'll just keep on doing them. And it is nice. And it is particularly nice to sometimes flick through and think, I remember, I was on the shore of Crummock, or, that was when I was in Buttermere camping. That was nice. Or that was a nice, pretty day. Or that was the snowy day. And some days are just like super boring. But sometimes you still have to doing it on the boring days because, it all builds up. So, I do have to remember that when I do them in the winter and I'm wearing my winter paddleboarding kit, I wear these quite heavy boots and they really, I'm like, oh, this is so hard. And then if I'm in the sunny day and I don't have any shoes on, it's like, whoa, this is really easy. Yeah, it's nice. It's just that, you know, life is hard sometimes and it's just nice to have something joyful to look forward to.
Definitely. And the fact that life is hard is why I started this podcast.
Oh, that was good, wasn't it?
And why I'm a pro, Jo. And why I asked you on, because I know that you've got such a inspiring story. It inspires me on resilience.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind.
And what does resilience mean to you, Jo?
I think for me, it's just trying to, because life can be very hard for all of us. And I know my story is no different to any others and many have had it harder than me. But I think it's just trying to find a way to be hopeful and to come through those difficult times, which life throws at us, with a sense of not necessarily positive, but optimism and thinking it will get better and I have it within me to make it better and to ride out those difficult things. It's not about life always being calm and it's not about it always being like super stormy. There's always going to be a bit of a watery analogy in there, but it's about, you know, riding those waves and believing that it's going to get better at some point and bouncing back. And sometimes it's a bit like that dandelion that grows on the pavement and you think, well done, little dandelion. You know, nobody cares for you. Nobody wants you, but you're there looking pretty. So I have quite a bit of a fondness for dandelions. I'm not a gardener, so they probably are terrible things, but I think they're quite nice.
I think most people chuck them out and call it a weed, but I love them as well.
Yeah, they're hanging in there, aren't they? And sometimes in life, we just have to kind of hang in there for the better times that are going to come and just know that they will come. So that's, I guess, my thoughts on resilience. But I do think, just if I may, and I hope this doesn't completely undermine your podcast, but I do think sometimes as well that we should try and make, you know, you hear a lot about building, about sort of schools and things saying, we need to build resilience. We need to build resilience. I also think sometimes we need to build a situation where people don't have to be resilient, you know. We should try and make life easier so that people aren't in a state of resilience the whole time. So that's just my penny's worth there.
And are you talking about a kind of wider systems and community one?
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea how we would create that. And so I don't have any answers. But I do think sometimes we, as life goes on, we expect so much of people at every age, I guess, because I've got sort of young sons in their 20s, that we expect so much of children and teenagers and young people that they've got to be resilient in the world. And maybe we could just give them a break and maybe just make life a little bit easier and not demand that they're constantly having to just deal with stuff. Maybe I've rose-tinted glasses, but it just felt a tiny bit easier in my 20s than I see young people having to face now, you know, cost of living and things like that. The opportunities just seemed a little bit brighter. And also, obviously, I was really interested in environmental things in my 20s, but sort of the environmental impacts that I see happening in the world just seem a bit harder. Sorry, I've gone like right off at a tangent there.
We've gone from headstands to politics, but
to climate change. I've got no answers, but it's just, I just do think we expect so much of people that maybe we could just try and make life a little easier sometimes for people.
Yeah, and a little fairer and a little more equal.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things that I've heard you talk about is ageism as well. And I just wondered if now we're on that subject of equality and fairness, whether that was a good time to raise that. I mean, is this something that you've come up against in your life? I'm not just thinking in your challenges and something that you've had to work through.
Yeah, I think So I grew up in the 70s and 80s where, you know, when you look back, I think it was the 50th anniversary recently of when a woman could get a credit card, you know. And
it's nothing, is it? That's like yesterday.
Yeah, literally. So I was nine, you know. And so I think, you know, I grew up, there was a lot of things about what girls and women could do, should do, opportunities that, you know, you look back and you think, I just didn't believe I could do that. That those were just never on the horizon, or we just had this subtle messaging that they weren't for us, or, you know, our careers couldn't go in a certain direction. So I think when you kind of have that, and then as you get older, you suddenly think, well, I was too young for it at one point, and then I'm now too old for it. When was I in, when could I have been able to do that?
There was a Tuesday in May that you missed.
Yeah, when was I given permission to do that? And you realize you were always too young, and now you're suddenly too old. And so, yeah, I do see it, not necessarily because I think I'm in, you know, a very privileged position. I have a job and I have been given book deals. So I know that I, you know, have had many, many opportunities in my late 50s. But I do just comments about ageism, about what older women should and shouldn't do, and that we should just get back in our box and things like that. And I see it in the outdoor industry. I see it, you know, who gets the funding, who gets on the stage, who's on the top 10 adventure lists. And I'm not saying I should be on them. I'm only reflecting on, because it was not long ago, it was International Women's Day, and they churn out these top 10 adventurers. And I wouldn't expect myself to be on, but there are many, many women in their 50s and 60s that I would have hoped were on. And the brands just keep churning out the same people, which is great. They're all amazing women, but it would be so nice to have someone who was older than 40. So sometimes I will go to brands and say, you know, you never show older women in your advertising. And they go, oh, we've got a woman over 40 next season. And I'm like, yeah, but over 40 isn't the same as over 50, over 60, over 70. And that gets me really annoyed. And whenever I put that on, I get loads of likes on my comment, but the brands ignore it. So yeah, I do see it, and I just keep chipping away and trying to do what I do and hope that in some way it might encourage someone else to think, well, I could do that. I could paddleboard, I could swim, I could go for a hike, I could skateboard. I'm really not a very good skateboarder, but I could try. I could do a headstand. I could take some time for myself. And whilst I never, ever, ever, ever suggest that I would inspire people, I find that a little bit icky, but I would hope that I might encourage other women my age to think, well, she's doing something for herself. What could I do that might translate into my life? I don't believe in the if I can do it, you can too, because again, none of us know what's going on behind the scenes. So again, I think that's very presumptuous. But I do believe that if somebody sees somebody else doing something, it might just give them that nudge to say, maybe I could do something that matters to me, if that makes sense.
It does. Though I would say that I find you inspiring, Jo. So sorry if that's a bit icky.
Very kind.
You clearly already have encouraged all these people. Was it so icky that you had to switch your camera off?
No, I don't know what happened then. There we go. Sorry, I'm back.
And this is how I've always known you, as you're so encouraging. You're always out there doing something, you're trying new things and not afraid to fail and start, be a beginner. But it sounds like from your story that that's not how you've always been. So I'm really interested how you have come to this place and what sort of things have led you here.
Good question. So I think, as you were saying a little earlier, I'm your typical middle child Capricorn, always wanting to do the best, be perfect, because underlying, I didn't think I was probably good enough. So I overachieved at all points and did a lot of things. And I guess I wasn't afraid to fail in my 20s, really. And then my 30s and 40s, I was very much a mum, and I'm divorced, so we kind of saw how that one went. And I think I, like many women, completely lost myself. I had some sadnesses. I had two miscarriages, as well as two, you know, wonderfully beautiful sons who are now grown men, in their 20s. And I guess what happened when I came out of my marriage and when the divorce happened was I felt so broken. I think there was a lot of grief from the divorce and a lot of I had the grief of the miscarriages and had spoken to nobody about the second one. So the first one was, I was on holiday. My parents were there. I was in a hospital. But I hadn't told anybody about the second one. I just kept it all to myself. So there was a lot of, grief that I hadn't explained or shared or, you know, lightened a load. And I think I came out of my divorce feeling so utterly broken, like mind, body, soul, everything. There was no physical stuff, but, you know, just the physicality of feeling my heart and soul were broken, that I could only go one direction and it had to be up because I had two children to look after. And also I had to, you know, put food on the table. And also at the same time as my divorce, my dad was first diagnosed with cancer. So I think when everything falls apart and you feel embarrassed and ashamed and in a really dark place and you think, right, the only way is up, you think, well, you learn to fail in what seemed like a massive failure for a variety of reasons, that you learn that it's so, I don't know, there is something that teaches you that you can start again. Like, I'm super into starting again, like for a while, and there's no problem sharing this, but for a while my password on things was, you know, new beginning, new beginnings. That's like my password, everything was new beginnings, new beginnings. I've changed that since.
Okay.
Just in case my bank's listening, I have changed that. But you know, it was like that you learn that failure, I guess, isn't final, you know, and that you can start again. And so I've become better at trying things because I know that there's something within me, deeply within me, that will say I can come back from this, if that makes sense. So, yeah, so the only way was up. The only way was, you know, putting myself back together. There was just nothing. I often sort of say it was like I was, like I could slide under a door because there was nothing of substance. There was, you know, nobody would notice I was there, or there was just nothing about me that I felt had any value, as I said earlier, other than making sure that my children were taken to school, brought back from school, fed, and we got to bed, and looking after my mum and dad, because then my dad subsequently had two other cancers, and then my mum had lymphoma. So, and she subsequently died. So the only thing I was good at was being a mum and a daughter and a sister and a friend. And even then I sometimes, you know, doubted myself there. So I guess I've learned to come back. And so now I'm happy to test myself in terms of failure, because I believe there's something fairly rock solid within me, which I never felt was there before.
And that process that you've just described from being that broken to where you are today, like, was that a slow progress? You didn't just suddenly jump out of bed and go, I'm going to turn this around.
Oh, God, no. Decade. Like, literally. Yeah. Decade, yeah. 15, 16, you know, from that, yeah. I got divorced a long time ago. Over 15, 16 years, my maths is working, my brain's working here. Yes, 16, 17 years ago. Yeah. You know, when these people go, oh, yeah, and then I did this, and then, woo, this happened. And I'm like, how did that happen? You know, oh, I was broken and broke. And 2 years later, I'm a millionaire. And I'm like, where did that come from? No, for me, it was like tiny, tiny step by step, adding a bit of joy here, overturning an idea about what I thought I could or couldn't do it. You know, it's those moments when you think I can't do that, and then you do it and you think, whoa, that's amazing. And so you add that to that building block. So it's all been teeny, tiny, tiny steps, just like rebuilding a wall and putting those bits back together. No, not quick. I don't do anything quickly. It takes me a long time and it's all very laborious, and I'll make it as hard as possible. But it's been a putting back together again. Lots of books, lots of podcasts, lots of time outdoors, lots of just nice times with people, really.
And when you described resilience, you used words like hopeful and optimism. And were those things that crept in as you were talking about seeing those little bits of joy? Is that something that arrived slowly?
Yeah. Like, I love the Emily Dickinson, you know, hope is that thing with feathers. And for me, hope's massive. Yeah. I have a paddleboard called Hope. It's about being hopeful that tomorrow's going to be a better day, or that it will work out this time. I spend a lot of time, and I have done this always. I've always done this. And my family will be like, where are you? And I am literally staring off into space. They'll look at me and go, where have you gone, Mum? And I do a lot of staring into space at a kind of imagined future where I hope to one day get to. And hope and optimism. Yes, I am a positive person, and that's a good word, but I think hopeful and optimistic. I'm always just thinking it's going to get better, and you know, joy is coming.
And you made that distinction when you were talking about resilience at the start, that it wasn't positivity, it was optimism. Was that distinction because of this kind of toxic positivity of like everything's great?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you've had a miscarriage. Well, let me think of all the really good things that we could say about that, you know. That I find quite difficult. I don't mind sitting. One of the lessons that I learned when my mum died was, and I think through my divorce, although I don't talk about it too much, is that I can be with somebody when life feels really crap. I hope I don't mind saying that word. And I'm not afraid of that. I'm not afraid of being with somebody when life's just really hard, and being with them and not trying to make it better. And I think sometimes, particularly with social media and this kind of positive vibes only, like some situations you just can't positive your way out of, but you can be hopeful and optimistic, I think, and be caring enough to say, like, sometimes people will say things and I'll go, shit, that's bad. And I can sit with them and recognize it and hold space for them without sounding a bit woo-woo. I'm not afraid if someone tells me, like, I don't cross the street if I see someone who's going through a divorce or whose parent or child has just died. I'm not that person. And that's what losing my marriage, losing all of that, and losing my mum has taught me, that you don't positive your way out of that. You look for hope, you look for optimism, but you also have to be able to recognize that people are having a really, really bad, bad time, and that you can hold space for them, hold their hand, walk side by side, care for them. So yeah, that's my distinction from that sort of toxic positivity, because sometimes you just have to recognize things are really bad.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. And if you don't, you're just denying how horrible it is.
Yeah. And kind of invalidating the feelings as well.
Yeah. It? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. You've got to recognize some stuff is just really hard, and you have to let that be acknowledged, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
And the word brave comes up. It came up in your film, and it comes up around you. And I just wondered whether that was part of resilience and having this hope and this optimism. Is it quite a brave thing to do?
Yes, I think so. Because sometimes, like for example, for me, through my divorce, I had bravery, like many people do have bravery forced upon them. Life comes and something horrible happens and you have to get up the next day. And so, yeah, I see, and again, I don't see bravery or courage in like these massive acts. I see it in those tiny moments. I mean, you know, as they say, bravery is like those tiny moments where you say, I'll try again tomorrow. You know, we got through today, we were all fed, nobody was injured, homework was done. You know, we got to bed and we'll try again tomorrow and we'll see how tomorrow and what tomorrow brings. So for me, bravery and optimism, courage, they come together because it's not saying I can conquer this. It's saying every day I'm just going to get a little bit stronger and a little bit more courageous and a little bit more hopeful and rebuild what was broken, whether that's a person or a relationship or a soul or a story or, you know, a dream, really. The dream that you had is gone and now you've got to start again and build a new one.
And when you were starting to rebuild after all those life-changing events, when did like all these activities start coming in? And I mean, like, how did it get that you're going to paddleboard across the country?
That's such a good question. I think that, so in the beginning, my sons would go and, you know, there'd be weekends they would go and see their father. And at the beginning, that was a relatively regular basis. And I lived in the country and I would go walking. And I just loved that. You know, they would be away for the weekend. I would tidy the sock drawer. I would tidy the crayon drawer and I would walk. And I would walk a lot. And as I said, it all happened as my dad was being diagnosed with his first cancer, which in a way put a lot of my divorce stuff into perspective. You know, we had other stuff to think about too. And so I just would recognize how much better I felt when I climbed a hill or been out in nature. And then I injured myself at the beginning of 2016. And then I set myself a little challenge to spend time every day outside at the beginning of September 2016. So like I injured my knee, it was healing. And I thought, right, I'll try something each day outside just to heal my knee. And then I took my paddleboarding lesson. And then I just was like, wow, this is amazing. I love it. I love it. I love it. And then 2 months later, I decided that I would paddleboard across from Liverpool to Leeds. So that's 128 miles. And at this point, I didn't have a paddleboard. So, you know, I'd already set myself this massive challenge that nobody had done, but I was going to do it. But then I was told at sort of Christmas parties that that was boring, logistically complex and too difficult for a woman of my age. Yeah, I know.
Your face. So I'm guessing that added fuel to the fire.
Yeah, well, it sort of did. But it was, like I say, I don't do anything quickly. I have to learn my lessons like 100 times. And instead of saying, yeah, whatever, which is what I would do now, I was like, oh, maybe they're right. Maybe I can't do this. And so I put the dream away for 3 years. And in that time, I was doing that just, you know, I went back to swimming and I went back to doing these different things. And I realized, again, this was giving me a lot of joy, you know, an awful lot of joy. And I was building up these tiny, tiny, I don't know, resilience, hope, optimism, bravery. There was just like these tiny little bits of me coming together. And then in January 2019, I realized that my youngest son would be going off to uni and I wanted to show both my sons that I would be okay, that I was, you know, not going to be on the phone the whole time saying, you know, what are you doing? What are you having for your tea? That I would be okay. But also in that time, I'd lost a number of girlfriends and only one of them had reached 50. And it's a complete cliche, but I say it all the time that life is really short and precious. And if you've got the inkling of a dream, the spark of a dream, you need to give yourself the chance to try and get to the start line. Like it wasn't necessarily about believing I could finish it, but it was about getting to the start line. And I then said, right, I'm not just going to go from Liverpool to Leeds. I'm going to go coast to coast, Liverpool, Leeds, and then over to the other side of the country and go to Goole. So that will be 162 miles. And I was reflecting on this morning that I used to post on my Instagram before we all had to do reels and dancing about. We could just put quotes up that could be quite inspirational. And there was one I read and shared in 2018. So, you know, prior to my trip, as I was building up, and it was something like, you know, there are people that are less experienced and less qualified than you that are doing the things you want to do simply because they believe in themselves. And I just had to keep saying to myself, I have to know that I can do this, because I think my whole life I've waited for permission to do things. You know, I've been the good academic girl that, you know, give me an essay. Yes, I'll get that essay done. You know, do a dissertation. Oh, I'll do that. You know, apply for this scholarship. Yes, let me do that. So I've always been the good girl that did the things, but I've never taken the things. I've never said, right, I'm going to do it. I've waited for permission. And these little things, these quotes and books and podcasts and things that I would listen to and read would just say to me, stop waiting for permission. Just do it, you know, grab it and do it. And so, you know, I became the first woman to do it. And what's amazing is that there are now 10 of us that have done it, which is amazing. And 7 of them are women, which I think is great. And then it was the same with the books. It was like, somebody's going to write a book about paddleboarding, and I don't, and I want it to be me, because I want to do it the way I want to do it. I want to celebrate the community. I want to talk about the environment. And if somebody else does it and they don't talk about the environment and they don't talk about the community, I'll kick myself, you know? And so I, again, thought, right, stop waiting for permission, and press the button and asked if I could write the book.
Wow. What I love about that is that out of such tragic situations and time in your life, it's almost like you came back stronger, a little bit bolder, a little bit braver than you even were before.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think whilst the whole kind of, I've worked in construction for a long time, so that as well as water, there's going to be a bit of construction analogies.
You might use me there.
Like building myself up, like building my, you know, the pebble here or brick here or whatever. There's also a sense, and Emily McDowell talks about this, of like excavating, and you're also going the opposite direction. You're pulling back the layers of what the world told you to be, particularly growing up, you know, 70s and 80s, of what girls could and couldn't do. And you're going back to finding the essence of the person. And I think that I am more like the little Joe in the 11, 12 year old Joe now at 59 than I ever imagined I would be. Everything I'm trying to do now, she'd be like, yeah, that's cool. You know, I have a Snoopy pen. She'd love that. You know, I'm skateboarding. And I'm swimming in the sea. And obviously we didn't have paddleboarding in the 70s, but I'm doing stuff that I think the Joe as a teenager would be like, yeah, you got there in the end, you know, you got there in the end. And I've still got the geeky academic stuff by writing books, you know, I'm still ticks that whole Capricorn thing, but, you know, I'm never going to let that one go, but I am doing things that are really joyful, you know, really joyful and lovely. I wish that life hadn't been as hard. I know people have had it a lot harder than me, absolutely 1,000 times. I wish it could have been a bit smoother, but I've got there in the end. So, yeah. Or I've got to the beginning again, of, you know, to a new chapter. Because hopefully this is not the end.
I was going to say, and then I'm like, no.
No.
You know, your life will be smooth, plain sailing, not a single worry after this, Jo.
It's all going to be fine. And I think, you know, it is that little bit in you that you know that nobody can take it away again. Yeah,
so when you were talking about that excavation, I'll stick with the construction. I suppose I'd probably use the word like uncovering. Like,
yes.
Do you feel that this bravery, this courage, this resilience, it's there? It's there in everybody, but we need to dig around to find it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. I believe that. But life can knock people down, you know, and for some at a much earlier age. You know, I had a very blessed childhood. It can happen. I do believe that within everybody there is that little gold nugget that is there.
And again, when we were talking about you learning new things, not being afraid to fail, I mean, that sounds so childlike, doesn't it? I mean, they just keep falling and picking themselves up. And at some point for me personally, at some point I started worrying what people thought of me as a beginner. Yeah. And that's quite sad.
It is. It's really sad. And I think that's what's lovely, like with the skateboarding, you know, one of the things I've learned about a skate park, like I go to a really lovely skate park in Leeds, and on some evenings it's every age. So as we talked about, you know, there's little tots, like tiny little tot girls on their little roller skates. And then you've got little boys. And like I told you about the little boy that is like, I was trying to put my hit on or do something, and one little boy was like, oh no, you're putting your wrist pads on the wrong way, because I was chatting, and he was like, no, that's the wrong way. And then another little boy was like, can you do this? And I was like, no. And he goes, well, here, have an opal fruit. And I was like, I really don't need it. He was like, I insist you have an opal fruit. And then you've got teenage boys and girls, and you've got, you know, girls just like so brave, so courageous, that young woman that I hoped I would be that I just didn't dare be. And then you've got, you know, adults like me and that we're all doing stuff. And then I go to an adult beginners class. And what is so lovely is we're all ages and we're all just encouraging each other. And I just have to remind myself that I'm on my own little journey and I'm enjoying it and just make it as joyful as I can, because it's going to take a while, but every time I do it, I'm like, I just feel so good when I come out. I'm like, I am just honoring all those childhood dreams that I just, you know, there's something lovely about it, and not worrying what other people think. Mm. You know, and I try and share on my Instagram, you know, the ups and downs, because I want other people to know that it's okay to take a while to get something, but it's worth it if it means something to you. I love it.
I love watching you. I definitely, I mean, like 2 months from a knee replacement, I'm not going to get on a skateboard, but
no.
Never say never. But one thing that stands out for me is like, I see you sharing so much about just this joy of just being in the moment, this joy of learning, and there isn't really a big goal at the end. You just love the process. But then I suppose you had quite this specific goal for the paddleboarding across coast to coast. I just wondered where that came from, like why there was this big adventure with a goal for that one.
That's a good question. Because I think at that point, as I said, I'd had bravery forced upon me. Like I had to be brave. I had to get up the next day as a single mum and take my children to school. And I had to deal with the stuff of divorce and residency and situations. And I had to deal with all the stuff that you don't necessarily want to have to deal with. And at the same time, Dad was going through his first cancer. So you have bravery forced upon you. And I guess this was the first time in my life that I had chosen to be brave. And through the power of social media, so that I could fundraise, I had chosen to put my head above the parapet and say, I'm going to do this. And I have no idea whether I am going to do it. And prior to that, in 2014, I had rode a million meters and two half marathons and a marathon in aid for McMillan Cancer and memory of my mum. But that wasn't about being brave. That was a very different motivation. That was, I am so heartbroken and so grief-stricken that the only thing I can do is fundraise for my mum. You know, I didn't care what people thought of me. I was going to do it anyway. This was different. This was a deliberate, I'm going to try and do something that has not been done before, but by a woman. A man had done it, Jason, in February 2019. And I'm going to put my head above the parapet and I'm going to say I'm going to do it. And I guess it was that first time in my life that I chose, that I could see in my adult life, that I chose to be brave. I chose to say, you know, I'm going to try and do something here. So that was different. And I guess I needed to do something big. I'm quite good at giving myself a really big challenge, like the rowing, like writing a book, like writing a second book, like trying to make a film, like going across the country, which I chip away at. You know, I'm a plodder. So I say, right, I'm going to get to the other side of the country. I'm not going to be pretty fast at this. I'm not going to be like super cool at this. I'm just going to plod away stroke after stroke. I'm going to write a book. Well, and that takes a lot of research, word by word, research by research. So I'm a big, big, you know, a million meters. That's going to be like 10,000 every other night for 8 months. So I set myself these big challenges and then I chunk them down into little ones. So why I wanted to go coast to coast, it just seemed really fun. And it was more fun than I thought it would be even. But I knew that I had to set myself something big and that a coast to coast resonates. You know, there is an element of what will resonate with people. But I like big stuff that I then go into bite size.
Yeah, you seem to enjoy the process as well. It's not just all about...
Yes, I focus on the destination, but I also like the journey.
You're also looking out the window as you travel.
Because I do like the journey, because I think in my youth all I ever focused on was getting to the end and making sure that I got 10 out of 10. Mm. Whereas I think I've learned the folk to enjoy the journey along the way. I think that comes with maturity and stepping outside the academic system and knowing that it's not just about getting 10 out of 10 at the end. It's actually what you've learned along the way. Yeah.
Is there a big goal for the skateboarding? Are you going to be skateboarding? No. On a jog?
I have
goals. I got a scoop?
My goal for skateboarding is I have this dream, like when I'm sitting, like I can visualize it now, I'm looking up at the ceiling, in either the Lake District or in Scotland, to find a very beautiful piece of road that we'll have to make sure there's no gravel on.
Safety
and
first.
I will be on a longboard. So I'm on a popsicle now, but I'll be on a longboard, which is a longer skateboard. And I will skateboard down this road and the sun will be in the golden hour and I will do it for about a minute. And that is my goal. And I won't fall off. And I will then complete that and then I'll go and do something. But that's my goal. As the sun sets, Scotland or the Lake District, golden hour, skateboarding on a longboard. And that's my goal. And if I can do that, then I will have realized such a massive dream. And in the, you know, that's what I, that's my goal, really. A minute, maybe 2 minutes on a very nice piece of road, somewhere beautiful, where you don't expect a skateboarder. Obviously, we'll have to be really safe and make sure no cars come and all that stuff.
That would be my goal. I watched a beautiful film. I think it was at a sidetrack night. And it was called A Land for Everyone. And it was women skateboarding in Torridon, doing pretty much what you just described, I think, from my memory.
Could that be Neon Stash? Could that be Hannah Bailey's?
Yes, I think it was.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd met Hannah years ago. Yeah. So I'll have to go and watch.
They were quite young. We need to bring it to a wider generation.
So that would be my goal. And then to just like sit with some hot chocolate chatting to friends. That is my goal. And just to do something really beautiful in what is seen as a very urban sport in a very rural place. Mm. And what is seen as a young person's sport as an older woman doing it. And, you know, maybe have some others doing it with me and us just having a really lovely time. So that's my goal. And that's what I sit outside and sort of stare into space at sometimes, and people are like, "Where are you, Joe?" And I'm like, "Oh, just some nice road with a skateboard
in the sun." And just thinking, when you've had these dreams, particularly in those early stages when you started doing a bit more and new things.
Yeah.
When you have these visualizations, is it always you? Have you ever found anybody that's doing these things, like your age, being through similar life, that was there to inspire you?
So the woman that inspired me to start skateboarding is in her 70s, and she's been skateboarding since she was 20, and I happened to meet her. She said she was coming up to Yorkshire, and I met her just before Christmas, and she's just so lovely. And I'd seen a BBC documentary about her, and she was like, "Just do it, just try it," you know. And so she was in, so you know, a 70 something year old woman was my inspiration for skateboarding. And I just remember seeing this video about her and thinking, God, that's what I want to do when I'm 70, you know, and I'm only 59. I've got tons of time, hopefully, touch wood. There are older women that have inspired me. They're not necessarily doing the things I want to do, but they're doing their own thing. And then I translate that into my world, which is sort of what I hope I might do, that people won't say, "Oh, I want to do what Joe does," but I want to translate that into my world. I mean, I have had some women say, "Look, I've gone for a skateboard lesson because of you." And I'm like, brilliant. Wow, that's amazing. And they'll be like 1,000 times better than me already. But for me, it's like nudging someone to do something for herself that she might not have done otherwise. I think that's where I am. That's where I am in the world, is just being that little bridge between someone saying, "I'm not sure I should do this. Oh, I'm going to do it." I'm not at the elite. You know, I'm not the elite end of things. I'm not these amazing people that do ultra this and ultra that and smash this record and smash that record and are the fastest and the quickest and the bravest and the highest and whatever. I'm at the start from someone saying, "I don't know if I can do this. I'm going to give it a go." And that's where I am going, yay.
Yes, you are such a cheerleader for that. And
I am.
I've heard you say a few times that you're not good at skateboarding. And I'm like, I'm quite surprised that you are using that judgment on yourself about whether you're good. That's not the point, is it?
No, exactly. And I have actually, driving through Leeds on the way home yesterday, on Monday, and I thought about this a lot, because I try and use visualization techniques and self-talk. And I know that when I was doing my coast to coast, I would say to people, I would imagine, you know, like, "Hi, man," if anybody dared, you know, if I happened at some point to go to a social occasion, which is very rare, if someone said to me, "Hi, what do you do?" And I'd be like, "Oh, hi, my name's Jo Mosley, and I've just paddleboarded coast to coast." At that point, they'd probably just walk away going, "Oh, God, you know, what a knobby woman she is." But if somebody would say, you know, "What do you do for a living?" And I would say, "Oh, I work for a church. And I also have written a book about paddleboarding around the country," or, "I work for a church and I also have written 2 books. So that I use that visualization and self-talk massively in other things I do. So I'm going to stop saying that I'm rubbish at skateboarding. And I thought about this on Monday. This is what I'm going to say. "Hi, my name's Jo Mosley." So if someone says, "How's your skateboarding going?" I will say, "I'm loving it. True. I'm learning a lot. True. It's going to be a journey. True. But I am getting better. True." So every day is a bit more positive. None of those are untruths. The underlying fact is I'm not that great, but all those other things are actually true. I'm getting better. It's going to be a journey. I'm loving it and I'm learning. And I'm going to rephrase it so it's much more positive. And I appreciate you asking me that, because I've been thinking about that myself. And I was driving along going, you can't keep using this negative self-talk, because it's really not helping.
I just feel like if I said to you, which this is true,
yeah,
I like stand-up paddleboarding, Joe, but I'm not very good at it.
Yes, I would tell you that's rubbish.
Yes.
yes, exactly. So I have to say, I love skateboarding. I'm learning, I'm improving, and it's going to be a journey.
Just stop with that. I just think stop it. I love it. Who cares about the rest?
Yeah. But it's when people want to know how good I'm getting. And I'm like, well, but I am learning a lot and it is so mindful. It's so mindful. You can't think of anything else. And that's what's so lovely about it. Nobody cares what you do for a day job. They're just there to just have a good time.
And it's not genuinely, like, I'm just thinking, is it mindful because I'd just be in fear of falling off and breaking bones? But is it, you genuinely find it mindful the same way that I guess?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I am surprisingly, you probably realize, quite a dolly daydream, and I can go off at a tangent and I can, you know, stare into space a lot and I can start a sentence and not know where I'm going to finish. But with skateboarding, there is an element of fear because I won't bounce as easily. You know, I see kids fall over and they bounce and I'm like, how did that happen? You know, that's not going to happen to me, mate. You know, however many opal fruits I eat, I'm not going to bounce like you do. But there is such an element of learning and being so focused on the next thing that I think it's truly mindful. It's not just fear. It's I practice the same thing like for half an hour and just go backwards and forwards, or I just practice and practice and enjoy it. I enjoy that flow and enjoy that practice. And then literally it'd be like, you look at the clock and you go, oh, crumbs, you know, I've got to go now. They're chucking me out. or not quite, because they're super friendly. But for me, it's really mindful. Because with paddleboarding, I can think of other things because I've gained a level of confidence. But with skateboarding, I just can't think of anything else. I have to just focus. And you come away and you feel like, wow, that was so refreshing. Like my brain has had a spa day, you know. I haven't thought of all my little worries, you know, at all. It's amazing.
And to those people that might be going through the dark period at the moment where things are feeling really tough, have you got any advice for them of how they get these little glimmers of joy and start turning the tide?
For me, I think it was doing things and noticing. It's a bit like Mary Oliver when she says, you know, pay attention, like notice what it feels like when you're doing something and you don't feel dread. You know, like, let's go back to real basics. You don't feel fear, you don't feel dread, you don't feel broken. Those tiny little glimmers, and notice them and try and do a little bit more of them. Like literally, like I would go for a walk and think, this feels good. And obviously now I've read a lot more about like the hope molecules that are created. Well, you'll know all of this from all your work outside, but the hope molecules, when you move, they literally are real things. They're like proper scientific hope molecules that I would notice that if I walked up the crag, or if I walked around the reservoir, or I walked anywhere, I would just feel better. And I would notice those things and then think, well, how can I do that a bit more? Like literally, if I go in the sea, well, I'll do that a bit more because I feel much better. And just taking those tiny things, or I'll listen, I love listening to podcasts, or I love listening to radio plays, or, you know, I make some bread, or I, you know, sit with a cup of tea and I listen. Like now the nights are getting lighter and you hear the bird song, and God, I haven't heard that for months in the evening. And just paying real attention to those tiny moments and then adding more and trying to amplify it so that you fill your life with more of those, so that it kind of just shines a bit of light on the darkness. It breaks up the darkness, really.
So that we're not looking for that leap from the depths of despair to ecstatic joy. Just celebrate.
Exactly. And also, I would say, get professional help if you need it. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to get professional. You know, I had bereavement counselling. I've had other moments when, you know, I have needed professional help to not do it alone. You know, I think that is super important. I think that if I had shared the grief of my second miscarriage, that would have helped because I bottled it up, you know. And so, yeah, just pay attention to those tiny moments and then, you know, write it down. Remind yourself, you know, I have like a thing in the morning and a thing in the evening. What am I looking forward to? And what have I done today that I'm grateful for? And sometimes, you know, in the past, it's been pretty hard, you know, but, you know, we were fed, the children did their homework and we got to bed safe and sound. That's quite a lot, really. And then the next day we did something and actually something really nice happened. So, yeah.
And just thinking of all the new things that came into your life when you started paddleboarding and skateboarding, like you must have met so many new people. And yeah. I just wondered whether you'd found a new community and how that's been for you.
Yes. I mean, with my books, I don't just write about the place that we paddleboard. I go with paddleboarders that are local. And so I've met some amazing people and they then tell me why that place means so much to them, either that lake, if it's in the Lake District or the whole of the Lake District or a coastline, you know, the coastline of Scotland or, you know, a particular lighthouse that we would paddleboard to, you know, why that area means something. So I've met some incredible people and I love then following their journeys on social media and seeing them blossom into the thing. You know, a chap was telling me when we were paddleboarding in Sidmouth about an idea that he had and to help young people with their mental health. And now, what, 3 years later, I've just written about him getting the funding, getting the structure, getting the charity bits in place in a magazine. But he told me about that 3 years ago and I followed that journey. And so it is just lovely to meet people that I wouldn't otherwise have met and to cheer them on their journey as well and sort of just be part of that, and our paths cross and then they go off and then, you know, they'll cross again. And yeah, it's, you know, it's just amazing, like seeing some of them go off and do these mad, amazing, crazy things and thinking, wow, you know, I got to know them when they were just like doing small things and now they're doing amazing things. Yeah, I've met some lovely people.
And thinking of that resilience, the kind of hopefulness, the positivity, is this something that we can lean on from other people sometimes if we are really struggling?
Yeah. I remember when Mum had died, I saw something which was, it was something like, your friends can hold the image of you for when you can believe that again or something. It was like, your friends know who you are and hold who you are. I'll find it. They hold that image of you until you see yourself again as that person, you know. And I definitely think I had friends that reminded me that it was heartbreaking and I still miss her. It was actually would have been her birthday yesterday. She would have been 89. And I still miss her every single day. And, you know, I still at times will, my mum used to love new food. And if I see something, I'll still think, oh, I should just tell Mum, you know, about this new type of watercress, you know. I'll be enthused and like, oh my gosh, I've never had this pea shoot before or whatever. Different, there was a new one in Booths, and I was like, oh, I should tell Mum. But your friends are there just to hold you and remind you that you'll smile again.
Mm.
Yeah. You don't, I'm such a Capricorn. I have to do this all on my own. And I realize that you don't, you know, friends are there to lean on because I'll help them. I think at one point in my life, I felt I couldn't share with my friends because I felt I used up my quota of bad times that I couldn't share again. Like, oh my God, I was having a bad time 5 years ago. I can't tell them again. But I realize that's rubbish.
I'm well into my overdraft, if that's real.
Yeah, I'm totally in. Yeah, that's how I thought. I'm totally in an overdraft of bad things to share with them. But yeah, you, you know, people want to be there for you.
Mm.
And I know I would never judge them. So why am I judging myself? Yeah.
When you were just talking about your mum, and I was thinking, how much of the journey did she see? Because one of the things that I suppose I feel a bit sad about is that my dad, I started running after my dad died. My dad was a big runner and used to do foul races. And he never saw any of the running that I did or the races. Yeah. But then I also feel that I might not have done any of that if he hadn't died. It put me on that path.
That's a good question. So mum, she saw some, I mean, I started the rowing because of her death. So the rowing, the paddleboarding, all that came after. But she did see, she did see some of the, a lot of good personal re-putting back together after my divorce. Yeah, she did see, I was in a good place, so to speak, when she died, but she didn't see the adventure-y bit.
Yeah.
I mean, she wouldn't have been that fussed about that. She wouldn't have been about that fussed. You know, she used to swim, but she used to swim in her jewellery and, you know, head up. And then she'd come out and she'd check she had all her, you know, her wedding ring on and everything. So she was not, you know, my dad's the adventure-y one. But yeah, she definitely saw me happy as a mum and the boys thriving. Yeah, she saw that. She saw some really good stuff.
And you mentioned about your book and how you went off to meet people. And I love that your paddle, I haven't seen your Lake District one, but the one around the UK, it's almost a bit of a diary. Like, yes, you tell us about the day. And I love that. Was that, I don't remember seeing many other guidebooks that are really like that. Is this a new radical way of doing guidebooks?
It's the only way I could do it. So basically, what really happened was I pitched a book to Vertebrate, and they didn't want the book I pitched, but they wanted something about paddleboarding and they wanted a guidebook, and I didn't know how to write a guidebook because, as you say, it's not how you normally do it. And then I had seen Susanna Cruikshank's book about swimming wild in the Lake District. And Susanna doesn't do a diary, and our styles are very different. Susanna's much drier. Whereas Susanna, she's just a drier sense of humor. I gush.
I was laughing at the fact that she's drier when it's her swimming book.
You know, she is. She just has a different style. But what she did do was she shared her experiences, and I thought, yeah, I really like how she does that. I'm not going to do it in this. You know, I gush, whereas Susanna holds back more. But it was a style that I felt gave me permission to do it in my own way. So it is like a diary, and I'm like, whoa, this is amazing. And whoa, we did this and look at that dolphin. But I think Susanna's had a big influence in the respect that she shared more than just, you know, get in here, get out there. She spoke about the place. She spoke about the geology, the history, the culture, and how she was very honest and very raw and very vulnerable about how the lakes had helped her with her father's illness and his subsequent death. So I felt like there was a space for me to do the same in a very different style. And it just became, that's just the way that I found I could write about the book and then have all the like super useful information afterwards. But what I was super worried that people wouldn't like it. But what a lot of people have said is, even if I'm not in, even if I can't paddleboard where you go, I feel I've gone with you.
Mm.
So I thought, right, that's you know, amazing. And it was actually, Susanna was doing a podcast with my friend Liv Bolton of The Outdoors Fix. And they did this podcast in lockdown, or I listened to it in lockdown. And Susanna was saying, look, I wanted to write this book because I thought someone else is going to write it. And likewise, she wanted to share stuff that she didn't feel necessarily other people would. So I was like, the next day I literally wrote to Kirsty at Vertebrate, like, oh, there's my pitch, you know.
And you make this sound like you know, oh, well, I did a pitch. Yes, they said yes. And I wrote a book and her, and now it's a bestseller. Like, were there any setbacks, challenges, doubts?
Yeah. So they didn't want my first pitch. So then I had to, you know, they said we'd rather have a travel guide. And I was like, yes. And then I came off the phone and was like, how do I write a travel guide? Because I was wanting to write a book more about, it was something like Wonderful Water Women. And so it was like the stories of paddle boarders, and there would be no real element of place. So I just had to change it around. I said yes, and then thought, oh, how do I do this? Because I knew I wasn't going to get the chance again. I knew that life doesn't throw, and I'd had other books rejected. So, you know, other proposals rejected, which were different books, some about the menopause and things like that. So they had been rejected. So I knew that you don't get these amazing chances often. Lots of setbacks. So I think we signed the contract in the September, October, and then we were in like lockdown again. So I couldn't start traveling till the May. My own imposter syndrome, my own anxiety, traveling around the country, you know, weather, just, you know, I think the Dorset one we did three times. The first was the winds were like 40, 50 miles an hour. The second was somebody got ill, you know, and the third one we had to get up at 5 to get this tiny weather window because I had to get back north for something. So, yeah. And then the anxiety of, is anyone going to like this? This is groundbreaking in paddleboarding. We don't have a big history of literature. We don't have a big library of books about paddleboarding. And here I am talking about glimmers and vulnerability and serendipity and joy. And, you know, is anybody going to read it? So, yeah, super anxious.
And how did you get past that? I mean, you obviously did, because I've got the book here in front of me now.
I'd signed a contract, and thank you so much. I'd signed a contract and I couldn't back out.
Really?
So, yeah, it was just like, and I'd started telling people I was writing a book. It was fairly obvious I was writing a book because I was going to all these places and talking to people. So I kind of made myself do it. And then I just had to keep believing. And, you know, as the book was coming out, I was not sleeping. And then I would just go and sort of sit in the Lido or sit in the cold water of the river or the sea and just and paddle out, you know, in one of the places that I'd written about, and just had to keep believing that if it meant something to me, that there would be a few people that would like it, and believe that Vertebrate wouldn't publish a duff book. So, yeah. And it's just knowing, it was just believing that, yeah, just believing that all the work would come to fruition, that it would, yeah, it would mean something to somebody, and then just hoping for the best. And yeah, it did. And so with the second book, I knew the style this time.
I wrote five
chapters and then tore them all up.
Oh, really?
Not great. Sorry.
Was the second book a little bit easier? Were you able to have a bit more confidence with that?
Yeah. So I was more confident because I knew that my style was kind of, I'd found my voice, and that people had liked the first one. It was easier in the sense that it was only the Lake District. So I only had one place to go rather than, you know, Mull down to the Lizard Peninsula to, you know, and the Welsh coastline over to Norfolk. So geographically, it was easier. There's always that worry about the second album, you know, is it gonna work? I was more experienced in understanding what people wanted. So I, you know, tried. I mean, there's bits in the book about, you know, how to go to the toilet in the, you know, because that is an issue in the Lake District. Mm. There's bits about camping, or obviously you can't camp on the shoreline, but you know, cooking and dogs. So there was more confidence that I could give people more information. Yes, I think it was easier in that sense. The weather wasn't great, so we had, and then I was ill when the weather was good, so that wasn't great. There was a lot of waiting for the wind to die down. There was a lot of rain, like, you know, we went from very dry to very rainy and very windy. So there was an awful lot. I think I went to Wastwater 5 times to try and get and not a windy day. And I gradually sort of was making my way along the lake. And when I did go, finally, the time in September, it was probably the best day of the season. It was just like glass. And what was good was I'd seen it when the wind was so high, the waves were lashing, and then suddenly I was walking on a mirror, and it was like Westwater really tested my patience and was literally revealing itself to me. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it, I was so grateful, because I'd seen it in a situation where you just couldn't paddleboard on it. You know, you could look at it and admire it, but you simply couldn't paddleboard on it. So, yes. And we had the photographer, James, who got some extraordinary shots, which the first book had great shots, but they were mainly taken by me standing on a paddleboard, hoping that I didn't fall in. and he's got some amazing shots that I just wouldn't have been able to get. So, yeah, it was a team effort.
And are you in these shots? Was that anything that out of your comfort zone?
Yes. Yeah, the first book, I'm not in many shots, which is happy about. And this one, there are a lot more of me. And I'm like, could we take that one out? No, Jo. Could we take that one out? No. Could we put this one? No. So a lot more of me, which is tricky for me. You know, I'm the author. I didn't want to be the model. But he's got some great shots if you just look past me. But yeah, there are some really nice shots. And what's great is we have pretty much, we didn't do January and February. We didn't do December, January, February because the weather, but we've got March to the end of November. So we've got me dressed in very different clothing, which I think is good for people just to see the you know, we've got some with a bit of snow on, and then we've got some when it's like super warm. So. Yeah.
And you mentioned that you'd had a few book rejections, and I just wondered how long it took you to kind of pick yourself up and dust yourself off and try again with the books, and how you did that.
I think usually, like, I had one idea that just everybody said no to, and then I had this idea which other people said no to and Vertebrate said no to, but then we turned it into the book we did write. I think probably about a year or two. It wasn't necessarily the rejection. It was like I just needed to come up with another idea that I felt was worthy. You know, I'd been decluttering and finding lots of journals, and what's good about that is that there are lots of the same ideas were swirling, and I needed to just put them into something that I felt was valuable. And so I would come up with ideas, but then I would reject them as well.
Oh, okay. You know?
I would just say, I'm not there yet. So I actually didn't feel it was massively, I think two things. Number one, the people that rejected me did it in a really nice way, and they came back with, it's not for us, but it's a really good idea, or we've got something coming out that's a bit similar, or you write really well, don't give up. You know, they weren't horrible about it. They were like really super positive. And I've had others since where I had one publisher seek me out, and then I went back with an idea, and then they didn't want it, and they had sought me out, you know. And so now I'm very much of the opinion that, you know, you've just got to keep trying, and it's not personal. It feels personal, but it's not. And it's okay. You know, I'm incredibly privileged, very, very fortunate. I've got two books, which is just incredible. And yeah, I think the fact they did it in such a good way made a massive difference to me. Compare that with I had an idea and I tried to get an agent and they never replied to me, you know. So agents just didn't even bother replying, so I've done everything myself.
Were these proposals all fairly recent, or were there any that predates like the divorce and what we were
talking about? No, they're all recent. Yeah, they were all in the last few years. Yeah, nothing. In my divorce, so before, when I was married, there were lots of ideas. I just never had the courage to think they would come to anything. I needed to go through that process, I guess. But they were always ideas. I'd always wanted to write books. I just didn't know what they would be about. I didn't think that it would be about paddleboarding and I'd write about, you know, mental well-being and the menopause and grief and aging in a paddleboarding book. But I knock them in. And motherhood and serendipity. And I didn't think... And my books have a lot of history and geography and culture and... Wordsworth and Sarah Nelson in Grasmere. You know, I put so much information in that I feel like I am trying to give people more than just the paddleboarding. So, yeah, I hope they like this one. You know, I really do.
We will. We will. And when's it out?
2nd of May. So that's 2 weeks away.
It might even. Mad. Oh, yes. I might try and put this out just before.
Yeah, thank you. That was very kind. And we met whilst I was researching.
We met in Booths. I was thinking when you were chatting about Booths, I'm like, she's always there.
I'm always getting booed. So Booths, Keswick, I was getting
it. And then there's me and Marcus going, it's Joe, it's Joe. Although I did meet you at in the Peat District at Liv's book launch,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, but we met at Liv's, but then when I was researching the book, we met in Booths, so... Yeah, and I do love those moments of research when you're just, you know, you're walking around a supermarket in neoprene and you think, oh, I'm on a little mission here, you know.
Oh, right, that was
weird.
I thought you were just buying snacks. I didn't realise that was important research for the books.
Oh, yeah. It says that it's, it was like I was buying a picnic. I talk about going to Booths and picnics quite a lot. And you know, walking along their aisle and seeing some of the other vertebrate books and thinking, oh god, I hope one day my book might be on the shelves here. You know, it's all dream building, all visualization and sort of positive self-talk.
It's fantastic, and I'm sure that 9-year-old Joe would be absolutely amazed at what you've achieved.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I hope so. She'd be happy with the snacks for sure.
Yeah. And what else are you coming? Did you get to arrange a paddleboarding book tour that I saw? What was it? What were you arranging in the Lake District when you?
Yes. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk from lake to lake and bookshop to bookshop. And I'm going to break it up through the summer so that I can also spend time with my dad. You know, outside work and things like that. So I'm going to then. Swim and paddleboard and hike and a little bit of bivvying and a little bit of camps and a little bit of youth hostels and go to each bookshop and just sort of say, have you got my book? Do you like my book?
I mean, you could tell them beforehand that you were going.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I will tell them beforehand. Yeah, no, I won't just rock up. And then hopefully we might, at a later stage, you know, do like a book evening or whatever. But I want it to be as flexible as I can. So, because there are some gorgeous, gorgeous bookshops in the Lake District, you know, that I just love going to anyway. And I read a lot around the lakes. There's a bit in the book that's a lot. I don't necessarily refer to this book or that book in the chapters, but they've enriched my understanding of the Lake District. So, I've read a lot from those books. So, we'll go in and tell them about my book, but also find other books to read as well. So yeah, the Lake District book round is what, so it's a kind of play on the Bobby Graham round. So the Lake District book round. So yeah, that's what I'm going to do this summer when the weather gets a little bit nicer.
And just carry on skateboarding and...
Yeah, carry on skateboarding. Yeah, carry on skateboarding on a Tuesday night. Just sort of thinking about what I'm going to do in my 60s. But have a nice summer where I know exactly where to launch paddleboarding and I know exactly where to eat, where to get my picnics. And just enjoy talking about the book and enjoy talking about the Lake District, really. Yeah.
and inspire others to get out and maybe try something new.
I hope so.
Or adventure. Well,
encourage. Don't encourage. Inspire,
okay. Encourage. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Okay. Don't be inspired by Joe, but be encouraged.
Yeah, encourage people. Yeah, I like to encourage. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Joe. Thank you so much. I finally got to chat to you, and thank you. You're such a cheerleader for everybody. You've been so encouraging just to me, and I know that you are to so many others. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And I'll put the links so that people can follow you and check on your headstands and
join in.
So where can people follow you? Is that better?
On Instagram, I'm at Jo Moseley. And my website is jomoseley.com. So that's M-O-S-E-L-E-Y-J-O. And Facebook, I think I'm Jo Moseley too. I'm not so great at Facebook. And I also have the Joy of Sup podcast on Facebook too. So, yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jo.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Resilience Rising podcast. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do help people find us by hitting subscribe, leaving a review, or sharing us with others. Thank you so much, and see you next time on the Resilience Rising podcast.